Lock the gate!
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fuck nicks? What's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast. Welcome to it. I don't know. I'm still a little jet lagged, but getting better. I'm almost sleeping through the night. Look, today on the show, it's sort of a double header. Haven't done that in a while. I had an interview with my pal Dan Pashman around in the can. We're going to throw that up. And Mark Arm, the guitar player and singer from the band Mudhoney, Seattle's own, is also here. So kind of a little bit of a double header. I'm going to go through some emails because there seems to be, I wouldn't say any sort of theme, not a theme, but people are a little touchy. But first, let's do this. Today is, Thursday? It's Thursday the 18th. I'm in San Diego tonight, tomorrow, Friday, and Saturday. But I just want to make sure that I give everybody a heads up where I'm going to be playing. Okay? Because it's hard to get word out. And I got an email from a woman named Carol who understands. She says, I feel you. Hi, Mark. I've been listening to you for years and never wrote in, but I just wanted to let you know you are not alone. At the beginning of today's episode, that was the other day, you were talking about how you got to keep announcing upcoming shows or else people are like, oh, I didn't know you were coming to my town. I am a program manager for a small nonprofit in northern Michigan, and this morning, right before listening to your podcast, I was gardening with friends, and they were like, you need to work on a better way to communicate about your events. I didn't know about your event Saturday. I told them about how I posted it on Facebook and Instagram. My boss sent out an email about it. We posted it on our marquee outside. Local NPR talked about it, and the local newspaper wrote about it. After pointing out that it feels like I'm doing enough to get the word out, they all shrugged it off. Well, I didn't hear about it. Huh. One said she saw it in the newspaper, but really I need to be better at communicating with people when we have events. So I just wanted to share my experiences so you know that you can do your darndest, but people are going to keep claiming it's you who is not getting the word out, not their complete lack of effort to seek out information. Keep up the good work. I really enjoy getting to listen in on your chats. Warm regards, Carol. Well, yeah, man, that's, I don't know. I guess it's annoying. It's really not about, I understand some people got to listen to me talk about places that aren't near them, but I'm just trying to, I don't go out that much and I'm going to be out a lot. You can go to WTFpod.com/tour to see where I'm going. The other emails, the tone of this one I enjoyed because I really hope this guy is a Buddhist. That would make me happy. And, you know, sometimes you guys, I don't even remember, you know, what I said. It's usually I'm making a joke. It's in a conversation. I understand things are delicate and things can be touchy. But the tone on this one was great. Buddhism comment. Hey, Mark, read D'Onofrio episode. Your summary of Buddhism based on meeting a couple of people in a basement cafe was about the most tone-fucking-deaf perspective I've ever heard. You sounded like a smug idiot. No, that's not correct. You sounded like a fucking totalitarian evangelical, though sadly many I've met are a bit more intelligent on the subject, so good job there. Didn't hear the D'Onofrio interview after that, thanks for nothing. Wouldn't bother even writing, but I like you enough to bother. Maybe because you're the only person who drops Dirty Uncle Bill references once in a while, or often displays a genuine humility. Who knows? On behalf of lay practitioners and your idiot listeners, who now have a new definition of Buddhism courtesy of Mark, try practicing right speech once in a while, which loosely translates to, among other things, try shutting your pie hole about shit you clearly know nothing about. I know it's hard, and your pie hole is your business, but hey, you're not alone. We're all trying here. Nice tone, Morgan. And yes, my pie hole is my business. But are you okay, man? You know, maybe you should meditate or something, or kind of like balance out a little bit. I'm not sure what I said, but it does. Like, it, I don't know. Is your chosen religion working for you? Wow. Nice tone. I liked the flow of it. I did. This is another one that I found enjoyable. Women don't fart, question mark, question mark, question mark. Oh, boy. Sensitive people. Hi, Mark. You said a couple of podcasts ago that when an opportunity comes to teach a lesson, one should take it and teach it without sourness or anger. So here it comes. I found the conversation you had recently with your guest, Kyle Dunnigan, about women farting funny but disappointing, to be honest. So it's take pause and know that it was funny. All right, the disappointing part is coming, but it was funny. I don't even remember what it was, but just for your general information, women are people and they fart just as much or as little as other people do. Oh my God. Are jokes really lost? I mean, like, do people believe fucking everything? Seriously. Just exactly how do you think that women's farts would smell less if they did? It still comes out of their arse, after all. There's no biological reason that would make women evolve to have less smelly farts. Oh, boy. The women in your life repress a bodily function so that you are not inconvenienced. And you, on the other hand, don't concern yourself with whether or not the fact that you don't inconveniences them. This should pretty much be the textbook definition of patriarchy, in my opinion. Okay. I know you didn't create the conditioning, but I feel that in that conversation, you inadvertently contributed to this conditioning. Imagine a teenage girl or young adult listening to that. With all the insecurities that phase in life brings, thinking you are the cool guy that you are, and then bam, she's told that her bodily function should be repressed because Marc Maron thinks women don't fart as much, so she must be sick or something. I know that this may seem trivial, but it's the little things that make a big difference. All this aside, I think the podcast is great, and I love your work in general. Cheers, Mel from Australia. Look, you know, wow. Look, I repress farts pretty regularly. I'm pretty farty, and I'm polite about it. So that goes on, and I don't ask anyone in my life to repress their farts. But you know, when they do fart, I mean, I might be like, "Wow," or like, "What?" or like, "Was that you?" or like, "What happened in here?" Or if I do it, I'll be like, "Oops." That was bad. I'm sorry. Is it still in here? I didn't know it would follow me into the car. There's a lot of things that happen, but I don't think this is really a fundamentally patriarchal problem. And, you know, I don't mean to argue, you know, I don't want to get into the, you know, this fight, but, I'll just say to my teenage listeners, feel free to fart, but you know, you're gonna have to take a hit. You know, farting, you know, it can hang on you forever. Like, you know, if you fart in the wrong situation, you're gonna be the farter. This is male or female. This is non-gender specific fart advice. You know, I think we all know innately that though natural, farts can be embarrassing and intrusive, and sometimes just like holy shit. Where did that come from? What did you eat? So I think on that level, impressive, but still, you know, not great socially. Okay? All right. But I do enjoy the new definition of patriarchy, almost that I'd like to repeat it. The new definition of patriarchy, according to Mel in Australia, is when a woman represses her farts so it doesn't inconvenience the man, and the man doesn't do that in kind. In other words, the man doesn't realize how much that is unfair because he farts freely. That's patriarchy, definition one. New stuff, learning new stuff. Also, you'll notice I don't fart on the podcast. You know, out of respect for anybody in here. I don't like the whole premise. I don't like using farting as a political or ideological launching point. So Folks, if you listened to the 1,000th episode a few weeks ago, you heard me and Brendan talk about our beginnings at Air America Radio, and one of the guys there was Dan Pashman. You might have heard Pashman on here a few times. I tend to have him jump on the mic whenever he's around because we have a good time talking about bullshit. And you may also know him from his podcast, The Sporkful, where he talks about food with people from all walks of life, including a lot of comics. Recently, he had on Maria Bamford, Josie Long, Ron Funches. You can go check out The Sporkful at thesporkful.com or wherever you get podcasts. That's The Sporkful. So this is me and Pashman doing what me and Pashman do when he's in town. I just created a file. It's called Pashman for No Reason.
I feel like all of our conversations could be called that.
Like, when I saw that you, when you texted me, you're like, I just want to see the house. I thought, well, do you want to, is this to get on the show?
Well, it was to see you, first and foremost, to see the
but
new
But was this in the back of your head?
It was in the back of my head that it could happen, yes. But I would have been, but I would have been very happy with the visit had it not happened.
But the fucking thing is like, I was about to just sort of like, all right, see you later. And then I'm like, we're standing in the garage, and I'm like, all right, well, let's just get on the mic and do whatever it is. Because I did see you in New York. I you know, I don't usually do stuff like that. Like, you know, it was a live Sporkful, and Brendan told me about it, and it was down the street where I was staying. And it was a live debate about pasta shapes, and I thought, what could be more relevant? Like, but what could be more Pashman? I don't know that you accomplished much that night. Do you feel like you made any headway on the pasta shapes thing? I mean, not, and like, I don't know if I give a shit, but I have opinions about it.
Well, that sounds like you give a shit.
Well, I agree. Well, I mean, I don't eat, I hardly ever eat pasta.
Okay.
But there was a time, well, I remember when someone introduced me to pappardelle, and I was like, this is pretty amazing.
Yeah.
You know, with the rabbit ragu of whatever sort. Oof. Or orchette with the
orecchiette. That's like the little ears.
Orecchiette. It's called orecchiette, with the. Well, I made it for a while. I had a recipe from some Bon Appetit Mediterranean edition, and I made it with broccoli rabe. That was the angle.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I made it a lot. And I also mastered bucatini la matriciana.
Oh,
I mastered it because I dated a girl who loved it, and I actually had to like kind of scour LA at that time to find guanciale because it was before the big artisanal meat explosion.
Right.
So finding guanciale in LA was not easy. I had to track down an actual, like I went to one Italian deli, they're like, what? And then I found another one who had it because it does make a profound difference in that recipe.
This must have been a special girl.
Well, I wanted to impress her and I also liked cooking and it was a challenge. But and it's a very specific sauce, that bucatini la matriciana. How is it?
La matriciana. Yeah, yeah.
You know, but the guanciale, which is a pig jowl, you can use pancetta, right? But it's not the same flavor at all.
Yeah.
It's a definitely different flavor.
What do you think about, and bucatini people should know, is like, it's like similar to spaghetti. It's like a long pasta.
Yeah.
It's hollow down the center. It's shaped like a drinking straw.
Yeah.
What's your take on bucatini?
I don't know. You know, I don't know that I would have used it outside of the recipe. I don't know what it's, I heard the argument on the show about the sauce gets in there. What, I don't know. It's a different texture. And, you know, it's kind of a fun texture. I couldn't really identify whether sauce was getting in or not. But, it, when you chew it, it feels different than other things.
Yeah.
That's really what it comes down to, really, with the pastas.
It's the chew.
Yeah. I mean, like, that's the fun of it. It's like, it's all sort of made of the same shit. So, you know, what does it do in your mouth?
Well, that's what makes pasta shapes fun and exciting.
Right.
Because it's all, you know, there are a couple variations in the dough you might use, but still, like, it's not a huge variation.
Right, right.
So, like, the shapes are what makes the, pasta different.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I thought it was a pretty good discussion. What's on your mind?
Well, I want to ask you, I'm curious, since I look up to you as a performer, like, like, you got any pointers for me? About the live Sporkful. Like, how could we do live Sporkfuls and make them better?
Well, I wasn't sure whether anyone was going to adjust someone's mic, and I think it happened out of necessity. like there was some, for you personally? No, I thought you did good. You felt comfortable. You listened pretty well. I don't know what, it was pretty no frills.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
I love, we had a projector projecting the Sporkful logo on the curtain on the stage, and the first thing you walk in, you somebody like, oh, what, you got your own curtain now?
It's like classic old guy.
Yeah. No, I'm like, no, we don't have curtain money, Mark. It's just a projection, okay?
It looked solid. It looked tight. I was like, wow, that's impressive.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
you take it on the road.
Yeah.
No, I thought you did a good job. I thought you were funny off the cuff at times. You know, I always like when people are recording a live show where they stop and they do things over. You did that.
Yeah, we did that a couple times.
You know,
yeah.
But I thought you engaged well. How'd you feel about it?
I felt good. I don't know if you find this. I feel like I've realized that I'm a bad judge of how well I can tell if the live event is good, but yeah. I can't tell if it's going to make for a good podcast when I'm up on stage.
Yeah.
Like you'll feel a strong reaction from the crowd, but then you listen back and it's just like it falls flat.
Well, you got to mic the audience. I was going to tell you to do that.
We did mic the audience.
Oh, you did?
Yes. Yeah, so we can
maybe
run.
It didn't go
we
well.
Can ride.
I didn't want to say anything, but it seemed like at least you had people who liked the show there.
But my goal.
I thought they were supportive.
Yeah, yeah. They were. That's why I invite my family.
Yeah. Well, I mean, but I also think like, you know, you are just arguing about pasta. So like, how do you know if that's going to kill? I mean, it seemed like, you know, like there were some good laughs and there were some like pretty emotional moments.
Well, in terms of your original question, what are we trying to get out of it?
Yeah.
Like my goal with that was really just to get people thinking about pasta shapes.
Yeah.
Why are some shapes better than other? That they have better different surface area to volume ratio. The sauce sticks to them better. Or they feel better in your mouth. Or they stay on the fork better. Whatever it is, there's not one all knowing pasta. Different pastas are for different purposes, but some are better than others. And so, I think a lot of people have opinions about these things but don't realize they have opinions, and I wanted to get people thinking because I am going to try to do this. I want to set off on this mission to create a new pasta shape.
Oh, okay.
So this episode, this live show will be like the beginning of that journey.
You are aware that the world is ending. I guess this is what we need to be doing.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we gotta like keep our interests intact.
I guess this is my coping mechanism, Mark.
I think that's what everything on television should be called.
Yeah.
That's what all things should be called. The coping mechanism.
Yeah.
That's what we're all doing.
I mean, I have been thinking so much lately about that bit you used to do about like maybe the people who are depressed are the ones who actually know what the fuck is going on.
Oh, yeah. Maybe the happy people are really the ones in question. Now, maybe depression is a reasonable response to the shit we're going through.
Right.
Well, no, I always kind of thought that.
Right. But it seems like
now
more than ever. I wonder if there's like
how is it not
a sequel or a follow up? Or extension of that joke that you could bring back that could be relevant to today.
Yeah, I mean, I think I could probably bring back that joke. I mean, the only argument about it is like, is what's trauma based? What is biological? Can people track their bad feelings? You know, I mean, that's what the real question is. But I think a lot of it is obviously a reaction, if not to the world, to whatever is in your life. Do you know what I mean? That it can trigger and stick.
Do you feel like you resent people who claim to be truly happy?
No, because I've learned that you know, if people say that, that's a red flag. You know, so you know, but there are people that seem grounded and have things in perspective, have peace of mind, you know, feel good about what they're doing in life, and you can feel that. You know, the happy thing. As my new joke on it is that, like, look, I'm, you know, happiness is a long shot. If I can have relief for 10 minutes, like, you know, that's how I'm geared. I mean, I've been doing a joke about that, like about how some people actually say that, hey, that would be fun to ... I've never said that about anything. you know what I mean? Like, if I can, like, not think about me for 10 minutes or feel some relief, that's as close as I get to joy or happiness.
Right.
I don't know if that's completely true. I think I stopped myself.
But I feel like when we started working together.
Was insane.
It was a long time ago. It was now like 14, 15 years ago.
Is it?
Yeah. We've known each other for almost 15 years.
You haven't really aged that much, I don't think.
Really? Oh, thanks. Yeah. But I feel like I was a lot more upbeat and optimistic back then, and I feel like you always had a skepticism of my outward happiness. Like, there must be something underneath this guy.
Yeah. Like, I think it's also your disposition. I think, I don't know if it's a coping mechanism, but I think you are sort of like an excited guy, don't you? You're starting to get humbled. starting to get beaten down, Dan. Beaten down.
Yeah, the weight of life. You know,
eventually the Sporkful is going to be like, yeah, it's not helping. This soup isn't, it's okay, but nothing is. doing it anymore.
Yeah, that's right.
So what else? So now you're down here, you're in Glendale for what?
I got some Sporkful tapings. I'm going out to have Shabbat dinner with some old Jews in Palm Desert. They do Shabbat dinner every Friday at Wendy's.
But does Wendy's do anything different for them?
They allow them to drink wine. They bring in their wine and their
the candles?
Yeah,
and
yeah.
The challah?
And they do it in the Wendy's.
And then they just order a single or a double or a triple?
And then, like, no, then Lou gets a Baconator.
Oh, the baked potato?
No, the bacon burger. It's a burger with bacon on it.
So on Shabbat dinner?
Yeah, yeah.
Uh-huh. What is it? So that's what you're going to do?
Yeah, yeah. But I've also, you know, actually, I'll tell you a couple interesting things I was working on recently that I was going to tell you about. One was about, have you ever heard of these underground tunnels in Los Angeles?
Yeah.
These go back to Prohibition.
Oh.
And they were used to smuggle booze under downtown LA.
Oh, yeah?
And there's like a secret elevator near this municipal building in downtown LA, and you can go down there and go into the tunnels even though I think you're not supposed to.
Uh-huh.
And I did this episode where I was just kind of like wandering around LA, kind of in search for this cake eventually that I needed to eat. But then I just was kind of.
Where do you stand on Tres Leches cake?
Love it.
The best.
Fantastic.
The best.
You know what? I always thought someone should make a Tres Leches cake with a Twinkie.
Mm. Why diminish it? Why lowbrow the Tres Leches cake?
Does anyone not like Tres Leches?
I don't know if everyone knows about it because I've made it before. It's the three milks. I think it's like condensed sweet condensed milk,
right.
Regular milk, and cream or something like that.
Something like that, yeah.
And you mix them all together and you just make this cake that's essentially a sponge.
Right.
And you pour it right on it.
It's so good.
So it absorbs it.
Oh, that's one of my favorites.
All right, so wait, so did you find the tunnel?
Yes. And
you
then
did?
I found the tunnels. They looked like the entrance to the tunnels looked like the hospital in Stranger Things.
Oh, yeah.
It was like super creepy. I couldn't believe it was actually like an official municipal building. And then I followed the tunnels for a while and almost got arrested. But then I came out and walked above ground to this bar that's like the oldest bar in LA.
Uh-huh.
And I convinced the bartender to take me down to the basement, and it was amazing. You would have loved it because you're interested in history.
Yeah.
I'm going to show you the picture. On the wall, the basement used to be a speakeasy.
Yeah.
On the wall, they have a mural of a tree. With all these winding branches on the tree, and it's actually a secret map to all the underground tunnels and the Prohibition bars. It's a Prohibition map.
Oh wow! Does anyone know about this?
I found it on Atlas Obscura.
Oh,
I'm gonna do a Sporkful episode where I just like wander LA with no specific mission and see what happens.
Uh-huh.
And I just started the episode by Googling weird LA, and clicking on the first link that came up and just following it.
Oh, what was the cake you had to get?
Oh, so a couple years ago, I did a Sporkful taping at Patty's Diner in Burbank. You know that place? It's just over the hill.
Yeah.
It's, I've been there since the 60s, old school diner. And I walked in before my guest, and I saw this huge coconut cake, like classic diner, three-layer coconut cake. And I love a coconut cake.
Yeah.
It looked amazing. But it was like 11 in the morning.
Yeah.
I was starving, but I'm not going to have cake. But then we sit down for the
tape.
Man,
you've changed.
I know. I really lost it. Yeah. Lost my edge. I had an omelet and I had coffee and English muffin and I did the interview, and then it's like 12:30 and now I'm just full and I'm like, I don't need cake.
Oh, you did it.
Right. then I get back to the hotel that night, and what happened?
What?
I was like, well, I'm a fucking idiot. Why didn't I get that cake to go? I should be eating it right now.
Oh, so you went back.
So 2 days later, I ended up back there. I was seeing a friend in Burbank and I was like, we got to go to Patty's. I got to get this coconut cake. And we went back there and it was, they were out of it.
Oh man, you blew it.
I was crestfallen.
Oh, but then you went back this last.
I set out to make my way from LAX to Patty's in Burbank.
On foot?
Lift, foot, underground tunnels.
Yeah.
Hook or crook.
What is this? Hookers?
Hook or crook. Oh,
what is this grilled fish you were telling me about?
Oh, you got to go to this place.
Huh?
It's called Coney Seafood, C-O-N-I apostrophe Seafood. It's in Inglewood.
Yeah.
I went there because... it's near LAX, and I wasn't going to be by the airport again.
Yeah.
But this is like one of these Jonathan Gold specialties.
Oh, okay.
It's not expensive. It's not fancy, but it's like Latin American seafood.
Oh.
Tons of shrimp dishes, like amazing, like aguachiles, like bright, fresh lime and spicy. And
oh, nice.
They do this whole grilled fish with these onions and the corn tortillas.
Oh, great.
It's ridiculous.
Oh, okay. I'll write that down. Now, let me just ask you before I make you leave. When you produce a segment like this where you're going to go to this Shabbat dinner at Wendy's, I mean, like, what are you thinking? Are you going to ask them, you know, like, where the tradition started for them and why do they continue it?
Well, and also I think it's interesting, like, they're all older people.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, we don't have that many older guests on our show, and so these are voices you don't hear as often, and I think it's interesting to hear, like, you know, the role that this, like, because some of them were not religious growing up, so it's interesting to me that food and Shabbat dinner is this way of connection for them. A lot of them are widows or widowers.
Right.
And so, you know, there's a loneliness to old age, and this, like, sort of quirky tradition actually has, it started off, like, on a whim and has now been going on for years, and it's taken on a lot of meaning for these seniors. So I think that's kind of cool.
Yeah, it's cool.
And then, like, you know, anytime you can just talk to, like, cantankerous old Jews, that's going to be fun.
Yeah. I just wonder, like, I mean, I wonder, like, why, you know, how many of them grew up with it and where they grew up with it. You know, like, did you bring that up when I was...
Yeah, when you were not paying attention. Yeah. When I was talking too long without making it about you.
No, I just saw that I had some messages. I picked the phone up to show you a picture and then I got lost.
Yeah, that happened at Carnegie Hall.
I know, on stage.
That was such a great show in a million ways, but, like, that was probably my all-time favorite moment.
I had to wait for the phone, and then I wanted to read the email from my dad, and then I started checking my message.
Yeah, you're literally on stage at Carnegie Hall. Like, you walked on stage, you were, like, almost in tears. It was such an intense moment. Halfway through the show, you're like, I'm just going to check my text here. Hold on a second.
Well, I wanted to read that email from my dad, and then I had to get my phone from backstage. Which
was, like, and we were all sitting, you got, like, whatever, 3,000 people waiting, and you're like, can someone on the backstage please bring my phone? Is it going to happen? It was a while.
And then she showed up, and everyone's like, yay.
Yeah.
I read the email from my dad, which is worth it. And then I was just, like, scrolling a little bit.
Right. And then you caught yourself. Yeah, you're like, oh, sorry. I'm not going to check my text right now. Like, that was so great.
I was very present.
Yeah.
All right. Well, so Sporkful, when do you drop them?
Mondays, usually.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we'll have fun out there in Palm Desert.
Thanks, buddy.
It's good seeing you.
You too, man.
You take care. You want to say take care again?
You too, man. Take care.
Yeah, because I stepped on it before.
That's cool.
No, we're going to put both of them in. All right, Dan. Talk to you later.
Thanks, buddy.
Dan Pashman, the podcast, his podcast, The Sporkful. You can get it at thesporkful.com or wherever you get those podcasts. It's always kind of nice to see Dan. No, it's always good to see Dan. So, look, I'm pretty excited about... I was pretty excited to talk to Mark Arm. I've been a Mud Honey fan for a long time. And, you know, it was brought to my attention that a lot of times if I get packages from Sub Pop that Mark is sending them, because he works over there on the dock, on the loading dock or whatever it is. He's the guy in charge of sending shit, I think. But he was here. He was in town. So I thought, fuck it. They got a new record out, pretty new at this point. The new one is called Digital Garbage. They also put out a live album of their European tour called Lie. But this is me and Mark Arm of Mudhoney. What brings you down here?
Well, I came down here for this, actually.
You did?
Yeah, and I came down a day early and stayed close to my friend in Venice, and we went surfing yesterday.
You went surfing?
Yeah.
Look at us old men and you doing things that are healthy. I went on a hike up the mountain.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you surf in Seattle?
Not in Seattle, but in the Pacific Northwest. Yeah.
You do?
Yeah.
With a wetsuit?
Yeah. Yes, of course.
I don't know anything about surfing.
It's cold there.
I mean, I know that, but you're probably cold here too, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Not as cold?
Not nearly as cold.
Really? So, like, from what I can see from surfing, when I look at it, seems to be a lot of waiting.
There's a lot of waiting.
But that's part of it, right? You just sort of like, I'm out here, I'm floating around.
Sure. Yeah.
And what do you get, like one wave a day?
Oh, no. Hopefully not.
Is that a bad day?
Well, yeah, that's a bad day.
Like, okay, so you went surfing yesterday. How many waves did you get?
Like 15 to 20, something like that.
Really?
Yeah.
Like, and how long are you up on the board for? Like 7 seconds?
Oh, we were at Malibu, and so the rides were kind of long. I don't know. I didn't have a watch or a timer.
No, I'm just like, I'm estimating. I mean, you know, I'm just like, I'm curious about the buzz of it. Like, for me, like, I go up this fucking hill, but I'm not having a good time. I'm happy when I get to the top.
Right.
But like with surfing, it seems like the payoff is like, I'm up. It's good.
Well, I grew up skiing, and then in the 70s started skateboarding, and then, like, as I got older, falling, skateboarding hurt way too much, and skiing got way too expensive.
Yeah, you can't skateboard now.
Oh, I have friends who are older than me who still do it.
Yeah, but how often do they break a thing?
They not that often, really.
I mean,
I mean, but at this point, they're pretty practiced.
Yeah,
I never just stayed in practice. Like there,
you got
like,
you got 50 something year old friends doing pools and
yeah.
Oh man!
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah,
is that? They're not doctors or anything. What are they doing during the day?
Some of them are in bands.
Yeah. So wait, so you skied? Like, where'd you grow up? Did you grow up here? You didn't grow up here.
No. I grew up pretty much in Seattle. Like, my family moved to the suburbs of Seattle when I was 4.
Oh yeah. For what? Was your dad in a Boeing guy?
Yeah,
he was.
Yeah.
So you're a Boeing kid?
I guess so.
Yeah, that's like everybody up there. What part of
not
town?
Anymore?
Now it's all tech shit, right?
Yeah.
What did he do?
Yeah, Seattle used to be like a really working class town.
Yeah. What part did you grow up in?
I grew up in the suburbs.
What neighborhood?
Outside of Kirkland.
Totem
Lake area.
Kirkland. Wasn't there a club? Didn't you come see me in Kirkland? No, you saw me at the old Giggles.
Yeah, I saw you twice at Giggles.
Yeah, I think you saw me record that dark night.
Yes.
One of those dark nights of final engagement.
That was one of the most amazing sets I ever saw. I was like, my jaw was on the floor. I'm like, this must have been what it was like to watch Lenny Bruce.
It was fucking, this is a dark time, man.
I kind of figured, because I saw the last of your 4 shows.
Oh, you did? Yeah.
And I kind of figured that maybe, after hearing like the CD that came out later after hearing the album, I figured that maybe, well, Mark kind of must have gotten everything down that he wanted to get down for the recording.
Yeah.
And this last set, he was just
fucking out there
free-forming. It was so, it was mind-blowing.
I was so happy you were there. I was excited.
Yeah.
I was like, fucking Mark Arm's here.
Thanks to Dan
Schwissel.
Yeah, for bringing me out.
Yeah, well, I mean, like, you know, before I knew...
I'd never been to Giggles before.
Really? Ever? You're not a comedy guy.
Not. I mean, you know, I saw, like, Stephen Wright in the 80s at the college, you know.
Yeah. Right. It's not a thing you do. Go to comedy. And that club is so weird. It was so weird.
It was totally weird.
You know, the guy who runs the place, he sells you the tickets, he makes the drinks, he serves the drinks, he goes up on stage for 5 minutes before you go on, and now it's gone.
Yeah.
So Kirkland, there was a place, wasn't Laughs, Laughs was over in Kirkland in that strip mall. I don't know if he's there.
Yeah, that was kind of not too far from the neighborhood that I grew up in.
So you're growing up, where'd you go to high school?
Bellevue Christian.
Oh, yeah? Were you brought up Christian? What'd your dad do over at Boeing?
He was an engineer, but I never got a beat on exactly what he did.
I talk to so many people who have no fucking idea what their dads do or their parents. What'd your mom do?
She, for a while, was an Avon lady and then, like, got a job as a receptionist for a paint company.
She did some Avon?
Yeah.
Had the products at home?
Yep.
Used them? Wondered why you were using them? Are these good? I don't know. They don't quite, the labels are weird, right?
Why is my son wearing lipstick?
Well, that became explained later because it was necessary. So she's working. She's a receptionist. How Christian were you brought up?
Well, that's a weird thing. I don't think my parents really went to church until like they moved into my neighborhood.
Yeah.
And I was the only kid. So like I was, you know, they're.
You're the only child?
Yeah.
Is that a lot of pressure?
Yeah, especially with my parents, yeah.
I always ask only children if they felt this weird pressure. None of them say yes, but you did?
On my mom's behalf.
Oh, yeah?
Like, you know, before I was born, she bought a baby grand piano, like expecting me to be a concert pianist.
Oh, that would have been good. You went the other way, but you picked up an instrument.
Yeah, but, you know, it was brutal.
Well, at least she wanted to pressure you to be in the arts.
Yeah.
You know, that's nice. That's supportive. But yeah.
Wanted to be an opera singer, but, you know, like she grew up in Germany and was born in 23
uh-huh.
or 21.
Oh, gee. She had to get out. Well, I guess she didn't. They were the winning team for a while.
No, she got out after the war.
Really?
My dad met her.
Oh, really? Stayed for the whole thing?
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess if you were German before the whole shit went down, you could stay.
Yeah.
Was your dad German?
No, he's from Kansas.
Oh. He went to Germany?
Yeah,
military?
Yeah, military.
So he liberated your mother?
Apparently.
Yeah. Well, good. That was good. That worked out.
Yeah.
And but to what does that have to do with her not being able to be an opera singer?
Oh, because like her career sort of, like by the time the war was over, she was almost too old.
Oh, but she was doing it?
She was
before?
Doing it. She
went to school
for
it?
She was studying it and then, you know, the shit went down.
Sure. A lot of shit.
Yeah.
There's a real mess over there. Does she have member? Does she talk about it ever?
I tried to get her to talk about it, and
she's
you know,
still around.
Like, no, she died in 2015. She was like 94.
Wow, good run, huh?
Yeah,
yeah.
I had old folks.
Yeah. Oh, you did. They had you when they were older.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
And she didn't talk about it when you tried to get her to talk about it.
It was weird to me that, like, you know, that whole, like, German thing, like, we didn't know what was happening to the Jews crap,
yeah,
you know?
Right.
And but she would say, like, you know, my friend who was Jewish and her whole family, like, they disappeared. You know, it's like, what did you think happened? You know?
Yeah.
Apparently, after Kristallnacht, my grandmother took my mom through the Jewish neighborhood and said, I want you to pay attention, look around, and don't say a word.
Uh-huh.
Like, apparently my grandma was not a fan.
Of the Jews?
No, of Hitler.
Oh.
Jesus Christ. No, you know, my mom was an actual Hitler youth.
Oh, really?
Which, you know, I think you had to be if you were German at that time and going to school and whatnot, right?
It was like they're demonic Girl Scouts.
Right. Yeah. And my mom told me that... when the radio announced that, like, Hitler invaded Czechoslovakia or Poland, whichever the first one was, that my grandma exclaimed, oh, good, that's the end of him.
Oh, yeah.
And you know, my mom, who was indoctrinated, was just, like, kind of looked at her and was like, what? And apparently she saw her mom just turn white as a sheet and realized, like, she has to be afraid of her child.
Oh, wow. That's heavy. Now it's a... Was your mom able to get it out of her system? I would hope eventually.
Man, you know,
Germans are tough, huh?
Yeah, she was always very rigid.
Did you learn how to speak German?
Yeah.
She spoke in the house.
Well, like the first 4 years of my life were on an Air Force base in Germany. So German was my first
language.
You were
language. Born in Germany?
No, I was born in California on an Air Force base.
Mm-hmm.
And then my dad got stationed in
back in Germany.
In Wiesbaden, yeah.
Uh-huh. Wow. So do you have any memory of that?
A little bit. Like, I remember it was going to be like my first Halloween. And this girl that I played with, I like bit her on the face and wasn't allowed to do Halloween that day.
You weren't allowed. For being punk rock too early. Bit her on the face. She all right?
I assume so.
Yeah. So once you get there, so you grew up with this, an engineer dad, does that mean he was engaged or disengaged or, you know?
He was kind of disengaged.
Yeah? Like a math brain, kind of quiet. Your mom was on top of everything?
Yeah, it was pretty much like that.
Yeah? Your mom cook a lot of German food?
Yeah.
Yeah? Like what?
Well, it's just kind of like, you know, meat, potatoes, and vegetables.
Yeah. Like, nothing fancy. No sausages. Schnitzel. Well, schnitzel a thing?
She didn't make schnitzel. She would do a thing called roulatten, which was like a weird, like pieces of flat beef rolled around ground beef.
Oh, really?
And tied up with a string. It's I couldn't really ever see the point of that.
Yeah. Was it good, though?
It was okay.
not great. So were you playing piano? Did she make you play piano?
Yeah.
Can you read music?
Slowly at this point. Once I got old enough, I kind of put my foot down. I'm not doing this anymore.
But were you good?
I could play. Like, you know, I didn't have the caliber to be like a concert pianist or anything like
that. Who plays the organs on the Mudhoney records?
I played the organ on Kill Yourself Live.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
Didn't you use any organs on some of the older instrumentals?
Yeah.
You did, right?
Yeah.
And you do that?
Sometimes, like Johnny Sangster, who recorded the last record, did the piano on it.
Yeah.
And Guy, our bass player, did the synthesizers.
I guess like it doesn't require, it's funny, like when you don't need a professional organ player to play organ. You just need to have the instrument in the room.
Right. But sometimes, like on our last record, we actually brought in a guy because we wanted like a Billy Preston type thing for a song, and I just knew like I wouldn't be able to do that.
Right.
And we brought in a guy.
For Vanishing Point?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Who was great.
Yeah. Yeah. It's fun, right? To bring in guys.
Yeah.
I was listening to what I listened to yesterday. I was into that Love You Live, the Rolling Stones record.
Oh,
with
right.
With Billy on there.
Right.
And they had Ollie Brown on a percussion. Like, it's sort of weird, right? When you listen to these bands, you know, how do they, like, you guys keep going, the Stones keep going, but you kind of mix it up a little bit.
Try. I mean, we still have our thing.
Yeah, no, you know. Exactly. Yeah, yeah, so the Stones, actually.
Right.
They got a few hits, those guys.
Yeah, a few.
Yeah, no, but the thing I like about the new record, and I was just listening to, which one, Kill Yourself Alive, that one, today, that song, is that, like, it's sort of weird to make it this far. We're I don't know if we're old, but we're certainly middle age, and now we have to...
At this point, like, when does middle age start? I was with a friend last night, and
we're in it, buddy.
I know, but it used to be middle age was like 35 or
was
something.
Was it?
Right?
No,
you know when people like died at 60.
I guess I think middle age used to be 40-ish.
Right.
But I think maybe it's around 50 now.
But like, I think like a couple centuries ago, middle age might have been 15.
Yeah, I don't think they looked at it the same way. I know. I don't think they were sort of like resting on their laurels or reflecting about the youth at 15, you know? I think the idea of middle age became, was probably around that idea where you're like, well, I have to be a grown up now.
Or the midlife crisis.
Right.
That whole thing.
Did you have one?
No, I think I had that earlier.
Yeah, I don't know. If you live a life in rock and roll and you stay in rock and roll, it'd be hard to identify what a midlife crisis would look like.
Right. It's not, I never felt like, there's something I really, really wanted to do that I didn't do because I like got stuck in this career or something.
Yeah, it would probably be the opposite. It's like, I'm going to buy a suit.
I'm going to get a nice desk.
Yeah, I need a desk that I could sit. I'm going to build a cubicle at the house. But there is sort of like, you know, the tone of that, Kill Yourself Alive, that song and the words of it. Like, I've done bits about that. My last special, I did a line. It said that we will all be immortalized as content, which is sort of...
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It's a similar idea.
Right.
Yours is a little more dramatic. But there is that, like, it's weird to have a sort of point of view that we have on this trend, this kind of, like, weird paradigm shift in terms of how people engage in life. And, you know, you sort of, like, the satire of Kill Yourself Alive, or the lyrics of that song, it's brutal because, you know, people have done that. They've actually killed themselves live for the likes. You've had that line in there for the likes. But like, what do you find when you with these records? I mean, how old are the people coming around
to the shows?
Yeah.
It seems to be like a good range.
Yeah.
You know, there's people our age, of course.
You know them probably by now.
Some of them. Yeah. yeah. 30 years in.
Isn't that weird?
I've seen you.
Yeah. That dude's here again.
Yeah.
Hey, what's up? I'm like, hey, how you doing? Like every year you see him, right?
Yeah.
It's kind of cool.
Yeah. It's great.
Yeah. But you finding kids?
Yeah. I mean, there's
rock kids.
There's always kids who are just like, find out about the old shit and they're interested in it. And they're also kind of maybe into some of the younger stuff like the OCs.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
those guys are good.
They're great.
When did the music start? When did you pick up the guitar? When did you make your mom mad?
I made my mom mad well before that. That's why I went to the Bellevue Christian School.
Oh, that was a sentence.
Yes, that was a sentence.
Well, like, what'd you do?
The final straw was when I stole a bike.
Uh-huh.
Just, you know, like...
For
fun? Junior high school shit. Well,
did you need it?
BMXing was a thing.
Yeah.
No, I had like a regular 10-speed bike, and
right.
I wanted to get into BMXing because like a lot of my friends were doing that.
Sure.
And
that's pre-skateboard or after skateboard?
Kind of around the same time.
Yeah.
And which is weird because like I was allowed to skateboard, but like I wasn't allowed to get a BMX bike.
Oh, you were forbidden. So
yeah.
Oh, okay.
So my friends and I hatched a plan
to
get me a bike.
Right.
And it was just, we were immediately caught.
Really? Did you know the kid who you stole it from?
No.
He just took it? He ended up at the police station?
I don't think we ended up at the police station. The police came to my house, and that was like the maddest I've ever seen my dad.
Oh, yeah?
Like,
you woke him up?
He was pretty reserved, generally.
Yeah.
His face I remember just being like bright red.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Me kind of like, and him being, you know, going around the dining room table like.
Yeah, know, yeah. Like, oh, really?
Yeah.
He was coming for you.
Oh, yeah, 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 yeah.
Yeah. And that was the beginning of the delinquency.
Well, no, that was kind of actually almost towards the, well, I'd done some shoplifting before that, but that kind of put the kibosh on that.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. And, you know, the thing to me, looking back on it, it just seems like really, like my parents must have just thought I was like insane and ungrateful. Like my mom grew up in bombed out Germany. My dad grew up in Kansas in the Depression. You know,
yeah.
And they're like, here, we've built this life for you where you just have it easy and you're complaining about being bored.
Right. Well, that's what comes with not having to work as hard as they did.
Right, right, right.
Is the boredom.
Right.
But you didn't have jobs?
I did eventually.
Yeah.
Not at like in eighth grade.
No. Well, no, I guess that's right. So the Christian school, so you had to go. Was there a uniform involved?
The year that I went was the previous year was the last year they had uniforms in high school.
Oh, got in under the wire.
Oh, man.
You dressed how you wanted. You didn't end up you didn't end up indoctrinated.
No. But like when we moved into the neighborhood that we moved into, my parents like looked around and there was a church nearby. It happened to be a Lutheran church. And they were like, we should probably take our kid to go there so he gets, you know, has a good influence.
Was your mom a Lutheran? That's a German thing, isn't it?
It is. But I don't think she was anything.
Mm.
She told me before that her dad...
Not since she was a Nazi?
Yeah. Like her dad grew up Catholic and hated the Catholic Church,
sure.
Apparently.
Yeah. So she was nothing, but they decided they want to get you on the straight and narrow and go to the church, be part of the community?
I guess so, yeah.
Yeah, but never sunk in, so they didn't get you early enough.
Well, like, you know, sort of half sunk in for a little while in there, you know.
Yeah, well, you know, you've got some Jesus. That video for the new, Kill Yourself Alive is the walk with the cross.
Right, right, right. I mean, you know, you get that shit pounded into your head and you're like, you know, I remember standing at the bus stop and looking at like a kind of terrible sky and just going like, oh, this is it. This is the end times.
Oh, yeah. Well, it is now.
But I mean, you hear all this like,
oh, sure.
There's all this, like, you know, end times crap, like late great planet Earth. My dad was reading these books.
Oh, he was. So he was a little obsessed with the eschatology,
trying to interpret revelations and crap
was
like
he?
That. You know, I think that was just, they would have like Bible study at church.
But
and like,
I said,
they got more and more into it. And I was just kind of like, this is weird.
Wow. So it sunk in with him, though, the revelation.
Oh, yeah.
So he was brought up with it, probably.
I don't think so.
Really?
I don't, yeah.
Got him late in life, an engineer.
Yeah, yeah, because I don't think like any of his siblings were
were
particularly religious.
Interesting. It is a little nerve-wracking when a math brain starts to look at the end times as a possibility and is kind of decoding revelations. That's not comforting.
I don't think he thought he was going to figure it out or anything.
But he kind of thought, well, it's not make sense.
I think he was just... Yeah, trying to make sense of things, and like he was actually just following what was fed him.
Yeah. When did you start playing guitar?
My friend Smitty and I, we started our first band like just after high school when it became quote unquote real.
Yeah.
It was a fake band for a while.
Oh, yeah. What do you mean you were just playing? Did you take lessons?
No.
No? Just picked it up.
My first guitar was like a pawn shop guitar that had the tuning peg of the A string was broken.
Yeah.
So it had like a flat old flat wound string on there.
Yeah.
And
it was electric.
It was electric, and eventually, you know, like learned about tuning, but not at first.
Sure. Yeah.
So we would just like make noise.
Yeah.
You know, and
what year was this? What were you listening to?
Like 79, 80. Listening to, at that point, I'd gotten pretty into punk rock.
It was happening.
Yeah.
Yeah, because we're like the same age. How old are you?
I'll be 57 next month.
Well, I just turned 55. So that was like the beginning of when punk kind of got to America-ish.
Yeah, you know, it had...
It was around, but it was hard to get.
It was around, and like people who are maybe a little bit older kind of were into it more, but like...
But it's sort of weird. It was kind of hard to get the records. I guess by 80 it wasn't, but like in the 70s, late 70s, they had to come up, like there was
but
a whole...
But the Sex Pistols were on like a major label. Right. Devo was on a major label, you know?
Right, but like the actual life of punk rock, the zines and all that stuff, you kind of had to be in this little network of people, you know, like for like the Minutemen or whoever or Black Flag and stuff to know when they were playing or to get gigs and stuff. There was a seemed from the guys I talked to, there was a network of young punk rock teenagers who kind of like grew up around or, you know, sort of championed that stuff.
Right.
Yeah. Were you one of them?
Well, I got to be one of them. Right. You know, first I had to kind of discover things.
Right.
You know, no one out in the suburb that I grew up with, you know, had I not gone to Bellevue Christian, I probably wouldn't. I don't know if I would have gotten into the music the same way I did.
Oh, thank God for the Christians.
Well, my friend Smitty and Darren and several other people were like, you know, who were in the very first band, Mr. Up and the Calculations that I was in. We talked and listened to music all the time. Yeah. And it went from like, you know, listening to 8 tracks of Live at Leeds and Smash, Jimi Hendrix's Smash Hits to like learning about Brian Eno and getting into Devo.
Oh,
and
that was my first thing too, Eno.
Yeah.
And right.
Velvet Underground,
right? You know. Yeah, from Jimi Hendrix Smash Hits with the three Jimmys on front.
Yeah.
Live at Leeds, and then someone's got to hip you to Eno, and then you're like, oh, there's another world out there.
What's
this about?
Yeah, there was a really cool record store in Bellevue that, you know, would go to.
What was that called?
It was called Roboto Records. It was a used record store.
And he was your guy. Who was the guy over there?
Oh, there's several people
that guided the youngsters into the world of that, you know, of the new music.
Like Johnny Roboto, who owned the store with his wife Helena, and Tom Dyer, and a couple other people. And, you know, they turned us on to like Ornette Coleman.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And they wouldn't laugh when I like brought up like a Jean-Luc Ponty record.
Yeah. Oh, they're like, what the fuck?
No, because I was just like trying to figure things out, and they were like totally cool with like, you know, find your own path or whatever.
So then like, so what are you guys playing? You doing covers with Mr. Epp?
No, we couldn't
complain.
Play.
Oh. Yeah.
The only thing we could do was make up stuff that we understood.
Yeah.
Which, you know, like made sense to us.
Right. Did you, this was the first band, Mr. Epp and the-
Calculations.
And did you have a following?
Eventually, towards the end, it was sort of the nerdier kids in the local hardcore scene.
Yeah. Oh, yeah? Why, because you guys were weirdos?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, we were outsiders. We weren't like, there was a place in the university district, like the street called University Way, which for some reason gets called the Ave.
Yeah.
And that's where like all the cool people in leather jackets hung out and stuff,
right.
You know, and we were just the suburban weirdos.
Yeah, doing the weird music.
Yeah.
And who was in that band that stayed with you? Was who Steve Turner was
Steve
in?
Turner joined that band for the last 6 months, and then the band decided to like not be a band anymore, and Steve were like, let's keep playing music.
And were you getting better? Was he teaching you stuff? Did he know how to play?
No.
He didn't know how to play either?
Yeah, no. I mean, by the time... I think when he joined Mr. Epp, I was a marginally better guitar player, but he quickly surpassed me.
Yeah. So you're just learning as you went.
Yeah.
And so what was the next band?
The next band was Green River.
That was a good band.
Yeah, I think so.
You guys had your shit together then. That was with Stone Gossard and the other guy from Pearl Jam.
Jeff Hayman, yeah.
You guys still friends?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah? They still live up there?
Yeah, Stone does. Jeff's got a place in Missoula and a place down in Encinitas.
Yeah, so, okay, so...
As well as Seattle.
So now is the scene starting to congeal into something? When does it start to sort of shift the Seattle music scene? Like, at that time, when you start Green River, you guys, what, did 2 records?
three?
Yeah. And that was named after the killer?
Yeah.
But that was like a straight up, like, what would you call that, punk?
At that point, we were kind of moving out of hardcore.
Yeah.
Hardcore kind of felt really restrictive.
Yeah.
You know, and like, oh, I love Minor Threat, but I don't need to hear another band that sounds exactly like them.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, sure.
It's like, what's the point of that?
Yeah.
And it seemed like, you know, punk rock went from this thing that had, was sort of wide open.
Right.
To like getting narrowly defined, you know?
Right. And that's right. When it started originally, Mike Watts sort of like it told me that originally punk rock was just like whatever you could, wanted to do. It was just like, if it wasn't part of the mainstream, it fit under the trip.
Right, right, right.
Yeah. And then it was starting to just be that fast drum. Just,
yeah.
And you guys, so.
And, you know, and, you know, part of like getting, for me, getting into, when I got into like punk rock, I wanted to find out where this shit came from. And that's how I learned about like the MC5 and the Stooges and, you know.
Yeah.
Like the basics.
Right. And you were always singing?
In Mr. Ep, I played guitar half the time, and I, like, Smitty and I would swap.
Uh-huh.
And
what happened to Smitty?
He's still around. He does cool, weird stuff.
Yeah? Musically?
Yeah.
Yeah? You guys still friends?
Yeah. Oh,
that's good.
I don't see him as, you know, much as I'd like, but...
Sure.
I don't see so many people as much as I like.
So when you put the Green River together, like, what's the scene? I mean, because it seems like, you know, what was that, mid-80s?
84, yeah. So I guess that's smack in the mid-80s.
So is it starting to come together? You're starting to see the cast and crew of the Seattle scene congeal or happen?
There's this very short-lived all-ages place called the Metropolis that a lot of the people that were kind of my generation went to.
Yeah.
And that shut down, and there were like a series of...
You saw punk shows there?
Oh, yeah.
Like, that's where they'd play? Like, Black Flag, Misfits?
No, Black Flag was kind of too big for that place. But, like, you know, Husker Du would come through, and DOA, and...
Oh, Husker Du, early on. That must have been a great show.
Yeah.
Okay, so that place closes, and what happens?
There's a series of, like, art galleries and halls and stuff that, like, get used, and then Seattle passes this like teen dance ordinance.
Yeah, what is that?
Well, there was like a club called the Monastery. It was a dance club, and I guess like some city council members' kids were going there and getting fed MDA and
one of those things. Coming home weird. Yeah,
it got closed down. And they passed this draconian. All ages law, basically, like to have any all ages space, you had to have like an insane insurance policy that like no one could afford. They basically
that was it.
Legislated all ages places out of existence.
Right. So then you
all ages shows moved to like Bremerton across the water.
Bremerton,
or down to Tacoma.
Yeah. So that was a big shift.
Yeah. So we would actually, you know, pile into a car and go to Tacoma or Olympia or something. You know, sometimes up to Bellingham to see shows. Around this point, I was like already like 21 and over. So, you know, things shifted into like bars. And there was like a couple of bars that would have us mostly in midweek.
As Green River.
Yeah.
Yeah. And who were the other bands playing?
Well, Soundgarden was around.
Were they? Yeah.
Yeah. Malfunction was a really cool band. The U-Men were around. They were a great, great band. But, they weren't like what you would consider grunge by any means.
When did Mother Love Bone happen?
Mother Love Bone happened after Green River split off.
There were some guys from Green River in Mother Love Bone?
Three.
All of them.
All of them except me and the drummer.
And then those guys were in Pearl Jam as well, right?
Two of them.
Ament and
Jeff and Stone,
were in Mother Love Bone, then went on to Pearl Jam.
Yeah.
And all right, so Soundgarden's around, you're around, and are you feeling like something's happening? Like, because like, I mean, everyone frames it like it's just a couple bands.
No, it was, you know, it was just like in my mind anyway, we were like just entertaining ourselves and, you know, my friend's band is playing, I'm going to go to that.
Yeah. All right, so Green River's happening, you guys are getting a following.
Yeah.
And then how does it break up? Why? Why does this happen, Mark?
I don't know exactly.
You don't know, you're in it.
Yeah. You know, I mean, I think, you know, people started wanting to do different things.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, and I miss playing with Steve.
Steve but we Smitty? Basically, Steve who? Smitty?
No, Steve Turner.
Oh, he wasn't in Green River?
He was for the first record.
Yeah.
And then he bailed.
Yeah.
And then we brought in Bruce Fairweather.
Yeah.
Who had moved out from Montana with Jeff.
Uh-huh.
With our hardcore band.
Yeah.
You know, got to move to the next big city if you want to get anywhere.
Yeah, pull them in from Iowa, from the Midwest, from everywhere. They go to Seattle.
Yeah.
Either there or New York or L.A. But Seattle...
Seattle at that point, like, no one was thinking of Seattle as, like, New York or L.A.
But it was a place where they could play music.
Yeah.
They knew that much.
But you could also play music in Missoula. You could play music wherever.
I know, but why'd they go to Seattle?
I think because they probably just didn't want to be, like, surrounded by cowboys who beat them up all the time.
There's some rednecks in Washington, too.
Man. Oh, there are for sure.
Yeah, buddy. Like, I imagine going down to Tacoma and stuff must have been heavy.
Oh,
Tacoma's all right?
Yeah.
Olympia. How about Olympia?
Well, I mean, you know, there was a very strong Olympia independent music scene.
Yeah.
That had been going on, you know, mainly based around, like, Evergreen State College and a radio station. Chaos? No. There was like a magazine called Op.
Yeah.
And then I think that became Option.
Yeah.
Like, you know, there was a lot of stuff going down there.
Yeah.
Like, people down there were like really plugged into like underground scenes.
Right, right.
Around the country. And one of those people is Bruce Pavitt.
Okay.
And that's how his subterranean pop fanzine was a thing.
Oh,
that he was...
oh, it started as a fanzine?
Yeah.
Oh, wild. I didn't know that. So, all right, so Green River breaks up for whatever reason, and Turner's back, and you guys start Mud Honey.
Yeah.
And then at that point, people are coming around looking for bands to Seattle.
Some.
Yeah. Well, how'd you guys, where were you starting out? By the time you start Mud Honey, it feels... You were ahead of the curve. You weren't really a grunge band. You didn't get kind of put into that, right?
I don't know I thought of what we were was just like another part of like the, you know, the American underground.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
Like in there with like bands as diverse as like the Butthole Surfers and the Replacements. One's like a straight up rock band. And the other one's like total weirdos.
Right.
And we just felt like a part of that continuum.
Right, exactly. And so, but you, like, your bass player was in the Melvins.
Yep.
That band, like, they have a huge following. And they're actually a band where I listen to them and I'm like, I think this might be beyond me.
Oh, they're an amazing band.
They are, right?
Yeah.
But I didn't lock in completely. I have all their records, but it's hard stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. How come he left the Melvins?
Oh, he got booted.
Oh, he did. He picked up the Melvins expelled people.
He was the first.
Yeah. But that first Mud Honey record, that was a Sub Pop record. How did that come to be? Because I remember getting that record. I'm like, what the fuck is this? And I loved it. I loved the first record. What year was that? 1989. So that's when things are starting to happen.
Yeah. I mean, we went to Europe right away.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And how were you received over there?
You know, it varied on the very first tour. We did like 9 weeks.
Yeah.
And the first couple shows were with Sonic Youth in the UK and a couple in Northern Europe.
Oh, wow.
Then after that, we were on our own for many, many, many weeks.
Yeah.
And sometimes we would just play a room in front of like a handful of people.
Yeah.
You know.
Sure.
And I think we had like maybe 12 songs.
But you're coming together. Your style's starting to define itself.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like, I feel like...
We had, you know, by the time we started, we had a pretty good idea of, like, the kind of thing that we wanted to do.
Yeah.
And it was informed by, like, you know, of course, like...
Stooges
and, like, stuff that was happening in Australia at the time in the 80s.
Who is that?
Oh, like, the Scientists and the Cosmic Psychos.
Where'd you pick up on that stuff?
Just underground fanzine world.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
I don't know either of those bands. What were they? They were just sort of doing like a post-punk rock thing.
Yeah, and the feed time were pretty integral.
All right, so like you put that, the self-titled record, that was a big break, right? That was supposed to be the big record?
Things were just sort of building, you know?
Yeah.
The next record, Every Good Boy Deserves Fudge, I think sold really, really well out of the gate.
Yeah, I like that record.
And then we moved to Warner's.
Okay. So what happened at Sub Pop?
They were overextended and cash strapped and you know, I think if we would have realized, I mean, this is hindsight and everything, that like they had points on Nirvana record and they would, that would keep them afloat, that we wouldn't have felt the need to leave.
So at the time when every Good Boy Deserves Fudge comes out around the same time as what, Bleach?
No, Never Mind.
Oh, so never, okay. So that was around the same time.
Yeah.
So now all of a sudden that's the biggest album in the world.
Right, right.
And Sub Pop, it's a Sub Pop record.
Well, no, it was a Geffen record.
Uh-huh.
But Sub Pop, they bought out their contract from, there's a crazy thing, in the early days, Sub Pop did not have contracts.
Uh-huh.
And I guess like the guys in Nirvana got like kind of freaked out and they went, we want a contract, you know? So that Bruce and Jonathan quickly, you know, scrambled and put a contract together. And
yeah.
So the Nirvana guy signed that. And had they not demanded to have a contract, Sub Pop would have not gotten shit on Nevermind.
And they would have been long gone.
Yeah, probably.
But they still made money off of Bleach after Nevermind.
Right.
So, okay, so this is all happening, and you, the reason you went to Warner was because you thought Sub Pop was going under?
Yeah. We first went to, like, Caroline, which was also a record label and distributed Sub Pop.
That's right, yeah. They did the Smashing Pumpkins' first record.
Yeah. And had a meeting with, like, the president of that company, and he told us, you know, what you really need to do is sweeten up your guitars and go on tour for 9 months like the Smashing Pumpkins. And after we'd done, like, a nine-week tour, we're like, we're never doing that again. And we're just like, well, this is insane. We might as well just like check other options because you get the idea that like the major label is going to be the one like putting the hammer down. And it's like this dumb little indie label was like putting the hammer down.
Well, they want it, like, but you guys, like, that rawness was what you were. I mean, they wanted to.
Yeah. I mean, that was just ridiculous to us.
Right. I mean,
I remember the first time we went in to record with Jack and Dino, he actually asked us, like, no, are you sure you want your guitars to sound like this?
Who's Jack and Dino?
He's a recording engineer. Yeah. Did, like, a lot of the early Sub Pop stuff.
Oh, okay. You sure you want your guitars to sound like that? Which was, it was a Stoogie sound, right? Just raw ass, kind of like, you know.
That was, you know.
Yeah.
I remember one time Lee Ranaldo asking me, like, what are you going for with your guitar sound? This is in the very early days. I'm like, well, you know, at the beginning of I Want to Be Your Dog, where like the first three chords come in and then it pauses and everything kind of breaks up. I want that.
Right before that part. Well, right before the riff starts.
Yeah.
That was the portal. And you locked into it.
Tried.
Yeah. And that was it. That was the main inspiration. So did you have arguments with these guys? I mean, what happened when you went to Warner? Was it Reprise Records?
It was Reprise. And, you know, we brought up the examples of, like, Husker Du and the Replacements. Like,
yeah.
You know, how come, like, when they moved to Sire and Warner Brothers, like, their records started sounding slicker and Lenny Warnocker, who at the time was like the president of the company, was like,
yeah.
You know, we just gave them money and they did what they wanted to do.
Is that true?
I don't know. But, you know, at that point, like, things were exploding with, like, Nirvana and Pearl Jam, and the record labels had no idea what this thing was.
Right.
You know, because it just came out of left field from, like,
two different,
you know,
it was like two different directions, too.
It was, you know, like, on one hand, they had, like, hair metal bands, and on the other hand, they had, like, Paula Abdul or whatever,
right.
You know, and then here's this thing that's just kind of come organically.
The salvation of rock.
From the underground. Well, I don't know about that, but, you know, definitely came from the underground.
Yeah.
And a lot of the people were just like kind of caught off guard. And,
but they knew there was money there.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
They were like, why aren't we mining the money there?
Yeah. And, you know, they knew that we had an association with all those bands and people came sniffing around and, you know, we found a lawyer who would, like, the last thing we wanted to do was get into, like, a bidding war, that kind of crap, because we knew we weren't going to sell shit.
You did?
You know, we knew there's like a limited appeal to what we're doing. Like by the history of the bands that we love.
Yeah.
You know.
Oh, right.
You know, like.
Your heroes didn't make it.
Yeah, yeah.
The best case scenario was not great.
Yeah, 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 yeah. You know, I mean, you know, we would say at the time, like, you know, if you look at our record collections, like 90% of the records are like bands that are also Rans. You know, sure, we got like Alice Cooper and David Bowie and Rolling Stones and Beatles in there, but like everything else is shit that no one likes except for a handful of people.
Right. And you're like, those are our people.
Those are our people. That's where.
But you never thought at that time, like, well, what could we do to sell more records?
No.
Okay.
I mean, you know, sell more. You can't like bitch about selling records, but like we weren't like going to compromise what we were about.
And you weren't hung up on making a hit.
No. I don't know if we even could.
What do you mean?
I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you got some hooks.
Yeah, we got some hooks.
but this was by design, not by insecurity.
Right. No. I mean, you know, by the time Mudhoney started, I was 26-year-old and had a pretty good idea. I wasn't like a 19-year-old kid, like, who was easily swayed.
Right. But, you know, you did, but, like, at what point did, because alongside of that scene, like, a lot of guys went down, man. The dope thing really took a lot of guys out. I mean, when did you see that happen? Do you know when it came in? I mean, it must have been sort of like it's here.
It was always kind of there.
Oh, really?
You know, like with like earlier in like the Seattle punk scene before like anybody paid attention to it, there were like people who were strung out.
But then it just got out of control?
I don't know if it was any more out of control than what was happening in San Francisco or LA or
Portland,
Minneapolis or Portland for sure not.
Yeah.
Portland was like, you know, they had a major dope problem in the 80s.
Yeah. And you just saw guys dropping, I guess, huh?
Well, it eventually.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
And some of them lived
a long time.
Like one guy like lived for decades and succumbed to cancer.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
It's a management thing.
Yeah.
Did you get fucked up on it?
Yeah.
Yeah. On and off? How long did it take you to get off?
I did it for a total of about 5 years, and the first 2 years were like, you know, like just sort of recreational.
Yeah. When you were touring with it and recording with it?
Recording, not touring. Yeah. None of the other guys in my band were into it at all. And like,
oh,
you know,
so you became like, ugh.
Yeah. they were probably just like, oh, fuck.
Yeah.
And then, the last half year before I quit, I was like, quit for good. I was just kind of chipping away at it a little bit.
Yeah.
And then my wife and I started going out and she was like, are you going to do this anymore? And my initial answer was like, you know, you never know what the future's going to bring. And she's like, if you do it ever again, I am out of here. And that was all it took.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
And you just got off it.
Yeah.
Do you have kids?
No.
Wow. So when was that?
That was the summer of 1993.
Oh, it's been that long.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, well, lucky you.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. Yeah.
What'd you replace it with?
I don't think I replaced it with anything.
No? You don't have that compulsive, addictive mindset?
No, and you know,
surfing?
Well, I mean, I guess that's kind of compulsive addictive because I kind of think about it way too much.
Yeah.
But luckily, I feel like I managed to, you know, like for a while, I stopped drinking and everything like that. And then did like an interferon treatment in the early 2000s, you know, which was a brutal, brutal thing for hepatitis C, you know.
Oh, you got
like those 11 months of
you had the hep.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, I felt like, you know, I thought like I got away with this thing unscathed. I didn't die.
Yeah.
I didn't pick up anything. And then like later on, I found out
you had it.
Hep C and.
Well, that's curable now. But yeah, then Huron, I mean, that's rough, man.
Yeah, it was.
Did it work?
It was 11 months and it worked.
Oh, you got it worked for you.
Yeah, yeah.
Beat you up though, huh?
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, like part of the warnings for it were like may cause suicidal or homicidal thoughts, ideation and tendency, you know, and action.
Was that true? For you?
No, I mean, I didn't feel like I was going to want to kill anybody or myself, but it was during the run up to you know, Gulf War II.
Yeah.
And you know, you could see what was coming for a mile away, and I would just like watch the news and just start bawling.
Yeah.
You know, my nerves were just so raw.
Yeah. How are they now?
They're a little more calloused.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah, that interferon beats the shit out of people. I've known people with hep C, they're like, I'm not doing that.
I think it's worth it just to get it cleared and out of the way. And
if you can, if it works, doesn't always work for everybody. No. But now they got a thing that seems to work for everybody.
Yeah, which is great.
It's expensive, but it's good. So I guess so. Piece of Cake was the last dope record.
There was, you know, we recorded in the same basement studio that we did Every Good Boy Deserves Fudge.
Yeah,
and that was, you know, one of the things. When we signed to the major label, we're like, we're going to put our foot down and do things the way we have done.
Yeah.
And we're not going to go to a big studio and try to make a fancy record. We're just going to try to keep it lean. And also one of the benefits of our contract was that what we didn't use in the recording budget, we got to keep.
Yeah.
So like, you know, we had like $120,000 to record. We used like $30,000 and the rest of it, we just split up and everyone put down payments on houses.
Good. That's a good move.
Yeah, that was the first time I did anything smart with money.
So you got that house?
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. Nice. Must be worth something now, huh?
Yeah, but you know, if I sold it, then I would have to just buy something equally expensive.
No, you stay in it. But it's nice to have, like, have to be able to look back and go like, that was smart.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So would you do four records on Reprise?
Three, four.
Yeah.
There's an EP in there, so.
And then when you went back to Sub Pop?
Yeah.
And they're like, they're back in the game. They do all right?
Oh, they do great.
Yeah, they're putting out a lot of good records.
In the warehouse.
I know. That was like that was one of the weird big lessons of like, you know, the rock life was when Schwissel said you were coming to the show, and then he told me like, yeah, he works over in the warehouse. Like, if you order something from Sub Pop, he's signing it out. You're the guy that...
Well, I actually don't do mail orders so much, but I do like...
Did you then?
No, I ship to stores and distributors.
Like, well, you sent me some records.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Those were good records.
Your
record and what, the Spider Bags record?
Hot Snakes.
Hot Snakes, that's it.
Hot Snakes record is fantastic.
Yeah, your record's good. The new record's, your record's great.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, I mean, now do you feel, how have you changed as a, you know, musicians over time? I mean, I know you're still doing the same thing, but it definitely sounds like you've gotten more adept at composing stuff and producing stuff. I mean, it doesn't sound like the early record specifically.
No, I mean, you know, you get better at what you do by doing it over and over again.
But like, how has it changed? I mean, like in terms of how you guys work together?
Well, we all have jobs and stuff and...
That aren't music jobs.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
No.
Just the survive jobs.
Yeah.
Like, what's everyone doing?
Guy is a nurse at the trauma center in Seattle.
He's bass actually, player?
Yeah, he is more on the administrative side of things.
Uh-huh.
Steve works at a pressing plant in Portland, Oregon.
Pressing what? Records?
Records, yeah.
Oh, yeah?
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And Dan drives Uber and Lyft.
Uh-huh. So everybody okay with that?
Oh, yeah. You know, I mean, I think in terms of making music, it's a really good place to be.
Yeah.
Because we're not relying on the music to, like, feed ourselves. And
right. You're not living that life at this age.
Yeah. And, you know, I like touring and playing, but I don't want to be on the road as much as it would take if that was, like, our only gig.
Right. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And when you go out, how often do you go out?
We're doing a series of like weekend shows, and then we've got a 2-week U.S. tour happening in October. That's going to be kind of it for the year.
Yeah. And do you like what kind of venues do you play in? What do you draw?
We're playing the Echoplex here.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And with the flesh eaters who are like
they're from the old days too,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
That's wild. And is it nice? I guess it, like on some level, there still like some camaraderie between, like, what is it like to have been? Because you know you were sort of a mainstay in a certain sound and of a certain time, and you guys sort of survived and kept putting out records, and you saw your peers become huge and in a lot of times not end well. I mean, you know, that must have some sort of impact on you. I mean, like, I don't know how well you, like, well, I mean, Mother Love Bone was the beginning of the sort of, like, you know, I, you know, visible people, like, getting fucked up and dying, but, like, you know, between Cobain and then the Alice in Chains guy, and then a lot of those Seattle guys, and then fucking Soundgarden. I mean, like, do you feel that level of success that some of those bands had something to do with them fucking, you know, their demise?
Well, maybe. I mean, it gave them access to a shitload of money.
Yeah. Right.
So you can just like, but it seems, spend it carelessly,
right,
on stupid shit.
I guess so, but it also insulated them. You know what I mean? Like, I think it's hard to, I don't know, like, what's the difference between like a Pearl Jam and a Soundgarden in terms of how they handled their, you know, their trip? You know what I mean? I guess I just don't understand. I guess I'm impressed with the idea that you're okay and comfortable with the way your career went, you know, as opposed to like these guys that, like, you know, they go up and they come down, they can't handle coming down.
Yeah, I don't know.
You don't think about it?
I can't get in other people's heads.
Sure. But you don't have any bitterness?
Oh, I've got bitterness.
Yeah?
Yeah, but not, you know, about that, I don't know, you know.
What do you have it about?
Oh, just like the state of the world. I've always kind of had a chip on my shoulder.
Right, but not about how the music's been received or how you're...
Like our music?
Yeah.
No, it's been gravy. I mean, when we started, like when I started my first band, I never even like conceived of anything like this.
Yeah.
You know, right. I mean, this is crazy.
Right.
This is crazy to like have been... The funny thing is when Mr. Epps started, there was this one guy who was involved named Peter, who like when we decided to like make it real and play our first show, he was like, you know what, guys, I'm out. I don't want to make music my career. And we were just like, you were insane. Like how, and he turned out to be right. Cause like, here I am like 35 years later, still making music.
And have another job.
And have another job.
Well, I guess like that's a certain grown up kind of like understanding of limitations and possibilities to where, you know, the heartbreak of committing your life to music can be pretty brutal. And he just knew that, like, no, I want to live that. But not for you.
I think he wanted to be a writer, which, you know, is like another...
Oh, that's another... Oh, sorry. He wasn't like, I'm going to go live a regular life.
No.
I'm going to pick something harder.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad that you're okay. But you're in this record, what happens with this record? How many did you make? I mean, is it going to, like, does it get radio play? What happens now?
I don't know.
Records,
you know. I mean, it might get radio play on like college radio stations and whatnot.
And on the Jesus video for "Kill Yourself Live," who are all those guys in there? They seem like people you know.
Some of them are, yeah, for sure.
Like other musicians.
Yeah, some other musicians. The guy who played Jesus, I didn't know before, but the director knew him.
Who directed it?
It's Carlos Lopez.
Uh huh.
He did also the "I Like It Small" video, and I mean, he's great.
Yeah, I liked the video. Yeah, I liked it. And where does that, what does a music video do these days? Where does it go? You don't know?
You just YouTube.
Yeah.
I don't know what the point is.
Well, it was good talking to you, man.
Yeah, it's good talking to you too,
it's
Mark.
It's good to see you. Okay, that's it. What a full show. All right? And free the farts. Free the farts. That's what I say. All right. But, you know, be prudent about where you let them free. That's all. Okay. You can go to WTFpod.com/tour for all my tour dates to see if I'm going to be near you. I'm in San Diego tonight, tomorrow, and Saturday at the American Comedy Club. There's a link to that on the site. All right. So I'm going to play some guitar. and probably not fart during it.